things are cheap. Archie's here. Betty's here. Veronica too. Reggie's here. Hey Jughead, where are you? Come on, let's go with the Archie Show.
Welcome to Archie Digest, a Riverdale podcast. It's a podcast about a story about a town, but we are smack dab in the middle of hiatus. Riverdale is gone until March 30th, and it hurts. But we're still here anyway to talk about the show. We've got some fun stuff lined up. I'm Chris Hayner. I'm from ScreenerTV.com, and alongside me is...
Craig Byrne from KSiteTV.com.
And Russ Burlingame from ComicBook.com.
All right, and since we don't have a new episode to chat about just yet, although thank God we will soon enough, we're going to talk a little Grundy, because now that the Grundy cat is out of the bag and people have had time to reflect, Russ, I believe there's been some interesting reactions.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, and the reason I wanted to kind of bring this back up again, even though it's a lot of people's least favorite element of the show, and even though it's over as far as we can tell, is as somebody who's constantly talking about how much I love Riverdale and constantly kind of being an ambassador for this show to people, both in my work life and on my personal Facebook, I've seen a bunch of people say things like, you know, that looked kind of good, but I watched the first episode and he was screwing his teacher and I couldn't do it. It's too disgusting. And so I'm not going to watch that show ever now. And that was weird. The first time I saw that, I was like, I mean, I kind of get that, but it seems like you really kind of jumped the gun on a good show for one kind of plot point. But I've heard that multiple times. And so I kind of, with no new episode to discuss and a little bit of benefit of hindsight, I wanted to kind of ask you guys whether you thought, on the whole, the decision to do the Grundy story in the first season of Riverdale was a storytelling mistake on the part of the writers.
Well, it's interesting you bring it up, because I just showed the Riverdale pilot to a friend of mine about a week ago, and he actually didn't like the pilot at all, but the part where he decided, okay, I want to turn this off, is when the Grundy's part came on, because he's like, this is really derivative. I've seen it on Dawson's Creek. I've seen it on a bunch of other shows. I don't need this, basically. And I kind of wonder if they realized it didn't really fly so well, since they kind of shoveled her off the board fairly quickly. So, yeah, I mean, and I know at TCA there were a few people who were like, yeah, didn't they establish that he's a sophomore, so he's 15? So that made it a little weird.
I'm of a weird mind about it. Is it derivative? Sort of. But what I find interesting is that someone would find this so off-putting that they wouldn't watch the show, but something like Freeform's Pretty Little Liars isn't necessarily a companion to this, but I feel like they're on the same wavelength and they're shooting for a lot of the same audience. Features a long-running story of a girl and a male teacher who started a relationship together, and now they're getting ready to walk down the aisle. And, like, it's an interesting line to draw for me. And I think what makes it stand out amongst things like Dawson's Creek is that the teacher was revealed to not be so... It wasn't a forbidden romance. That Riverdale lulled you into thinking it was a forbidden romance, but at the end of the day, what it was is a predator was pouncing on her prey.
And that's something we talked about a little bit, and part of the reason that I'm so surprised that so many people have been kind of unilateral about this, that like, nope, not doing it, is that I really felt like this is a story that's kind of gross and in bad taste, but it's a thing that happens both in real life and on television a lot. And I felt like the Riverdale writers did as good a job handling it as I have seen. Because you didn't immediately just jump right into the, like, she's a horrible, totally disgusting and unsympathetic person. Like, they did try to make it almost seem like they were going to do the forbidden love angle, mm-hmm. but then by like episode 3 they were just like, oh no, this is clearly not a good situation. And the more people got involved, it's like literally nobody was, I don't know, I felt like at no point did it feel like Archie knew what he was talking about and everybody else was being unreasonable, which is how I think these things often get spun on television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I felt like that was to the credit of the writers. I really felt like you know, you hit it on the head by saying, like, no, she was clearly a predator. Like, this was clearly a story that they explored for a specific dramatic impact and not for titillation.
Right. But at the same time, if someone was turned off by it and the pilot didn't follow through, I can't really blame them, because they subtly make nods to it being that sort of relationship in the pilot, but for the most part, they sort of dance around the idea, and they make it seem like it's this naughty, sexy, forbidden thing, when in reality, it's not.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked about that a little bit last episode or the episode before, the idea that there are certain things in the pilot that get set up that it's hard to tell whether they wanted to leave doors open to go a different way, or whether they always knew where they were going to go with things, and it's just that that's the cost of doing a pilot months before you do the rest of the season.
Yeah.
I don't know. I do think I do agree that they handled it very well, though, and that, you know, they didn't portray her as sympathetic in the least, which was probably a wise choice. So.
Yeah, and I mean, I do think, I know a lot of people, including some of the people who are big, like, listeners to our show. Like, I think Betty and Juggy, when we tweeted something about Grundy the other day, they were like, nope, keep her out of here. So I know a lot of people feel like you don't ever want to see that character in that storyline again, which is fair. I also think that the way that they did it, from a writing perspective, leaves things open. Like, you don't...
Totally.
You don't feel bad for her in any way. But if we were to assume for the sake of argument that her story is actually real and that she had an abusive husband someplace, there's a decent chance that he could be somehow wrapped up in Jason Blossom's murder.
Or that she is.
Right. And like, to me, I think that the fact that, you know, we are 7 episodes in as of the last episode that aired, and 2 weeks ago when we had Lindsay on from Screener, she was saying that she still thought Grundy was a legit suspect, in spite of the fact that Grundy hasn't been seen since episode 4. Like, that tells me that in terms of building a murder mystery, this whole storyline at least wasn't entirely a mistake, because you've at a bare minimum created a really good red herring with a character who people know is kind of despicable.
Pun intended.
Well, you know.
Yeah.
Communism is just a red herring.
She did, you know, tutor 2 redheads, so.
True.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think there's a lot of, and also it kind of, from a story perspective, gave a point of Archie not being able to admit where he was and why, because then he would be admitting the Grundy thing, and she was pressuring him not to. So there's that extra level, but, I mean, I would think if I wasn't pretty sure that Grundy wasn't coming back, I would think she was totally coming back and that she has a major role in whatever happened to Jason Blossom. If she doesn't come back, obviously she didn't, but...
Right.
Yeah.
Or did she? Da, da, da.
But what if she didn't?
What if Sheriff Keller is her abusive ex-husband?
I quit.
Oh, no. That would mean she was sleeping with someone her son's age.
That's true.
Yeah, no. Sure. No.
She doesn't have a son.
She could be Kevin Keller's mother.
Oh.
Yeah.
Not only is she sleeping with someone her son's age, she's sleeping with one of her son's friends.
Gosh.
Grundy.
Although I feel like it probably... Yeah, I feel like that probably would have been referenced at some point, but, you know, you never know.
The only other thing that, is kind of a negative, though, about the whole Grundy relationship is now it feels like the real Miss Grundy is completely off the board for the show. And since Miss Grundy has always been a major character of the Archie Comics canon, that's a little unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yes, but at the same time, a show like this on the CW can only really have room for so many senior citizen characters.
True, but...
I don't know. We have Weatherby's there, Pop Tate is there sometimes.
When he feels like it. And they don't call him Pops, at least.
That's true.
Thanks God.
Spoilers, guys. We just recorded this literally moments after we finished the To Riverdale and Back Again episode. So we're still kind of burned by that experience.
That's the opposite of spoilers.
Yeah, which you can find at archiedigest.podbean.com.
We're spoiling something from last week.
Are still complaining that people still complain about spoilers if it's only a week old.
Fair.
Did you know Betty and Jughead kissed?
Oh boy, did they ever.
I just spoiled people. Sorry. Jason Blossom's dead, and I think Sheriff Keller killed him.
I don't.
Anyway.
You know, yeah. Jason used to
going, like, to sort of, for my, at least for my last words on the Grundy of it all, I appreciated the way they handled the story compared to the way it's been handled other times on TV. Did they need to do this story? No. But, you know, pilots do what pilots do. And it made it, let's be honest, it's the most interesting thing Archie's done so far, which doesn't say a lot about Archie, but that's kind of the whole point of Archie. So was it perfect? No, of course it wasn't. It didn't have to happen, but the way it happened worked out really well, I thought. But if it was enough to turn people off, then that's fine. That just happens sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair assessment. One of the things that's, now when I think back on it, I remember being kind of turned off by that element in the initial plot description. And I can't remember if that was mostly because I was annoyed that they would blow something like that in the initial plot description versus letting it play out in the episode. But I will say that as much as it was not a thing I particularly had any interest in going in, and probably it's not a thing that I would ever put in a pilot I was writing, certainly I think they handled it as well as they could. And it's one of those things, like, at a bare minimum, you know, if we're saying, was it a poor storytelling choice on the part of the writers? You could probably say, at the end of the day, Roberto didn't need to do this, and a lot of people would have preferred that it was never on the show to begin with. And that's totally fair. In terms of what the writer's room was handed, they were handed a pilot script where this was a major part of the plot. And I think that, you know, from that point forward, they did as well with it as you could possibly expect them to do.
Yeah.
And the show quickly moved away from it. I mean, as soon as Grundy was gone, the very next episode, Archie and Valerie started getting close. And I think that was a lot more appropriate and a lot better. But, yeah, you know, somebody would have to stay through episode 5 to see that. And hopefully, I really hope people end up binging this show and just seeing how good it is. It's all I want in life.
But also, I think it's safe for us to say, I don't think it's delving too much into spoiler territory, but the show, while we won't see Sarah Hamill back this season as Grundy, the show will touch back on that storyline sort of directly. I don't know how to phrase it without spoiling it, but like, the show isn't just going to mysteriously forget that Archie had an affair with his predator teacher.
Yeah,
even if we don't
see that predator in person. Oh, I might. We could talk about it off air.
Grundy's the killer.
No, well, maybe.
Teacher killer, not sheriff killer. Teacher killer. Anyway.
Psycho killer.
All right. Thanks, gentlemen, for this chat. This is a weird episode because, as we said, there's no Riverdale this week.
From this point forward, I'm kind of flying solo. I'm going to have a little assist from my co-host on the Emerald City Video Podcast. It's part one of a two-part crossover with that podcast, looking at, well, we'll get to that after this message from my good friends at the From Crisis to Crisis podcast.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Mike. I'm trailing.
Man, it sure is great to be back to FCTC after such a long time.
Yes, it is, and we've been away so long.
Yeah, but real life, and you know what? I just can't do this.
Can't do what?
We have taken more breaks from this show than my wife has had in her entire life. I mean, we can talk about real life getting in the way.
Which it has.
But it's just not fair. So we're not going to joke around, and we're going to simply say that for the moment, we're back, and there's a lot of neat stuff to talk about.
Like season 2 of Lois and Clark.
And the death of Clark Kent.
And the launch of Superman the Man of Tomorrow.
And the return of Lex Luthor.
And the trial of Superman.
And Underworld Unleashed.
The show can still be found at the Superman homepage, as well as at the Fortress of Baileytude.
And we're still part of the Superman Podcast Network.
So From Crisis to Crisis is back.
For now.
And it will still come out on Thursdays.
Most week at www.fortressofbaileytude.com, www.supermanhomepage.com, or www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
We're back, everybody. And a little something different in this episode. Well, I mean, a little something different is kind of the name of the game in this episode. But particularly, let me introduce all of our listeners to Zach Roberts.
Hello.
Zach is one of my co-hosts, and I would say the by far the most regular co-host on the Emerald City Video Podcast. And that is a podcast I've talked about almost every episode of the Archie Digest podcast. But if Archie Digest is a podcast about a story about a town, Emerald City Video is a podcast about a bunch of people who worked at the video store.
True.
And basically, there was a video store here in Syracuse, you know, years ago. And myself and everybody who has been a host on the Emerald City Video Podcast were at one point or another employees there, including Zach. We do a podcast where we talk about movies, and typically our format is that we'll talk about one new movie and one old movie thing we used to do at the video store. We had a rent one, get one deal if you paid full price on anything. So, you know, you would get a new release and you could get an older movie for free.
Yep.
But this time, because we have a fairly limited amount of time for this exciting two-show crossover, I wanted to talk a little bit about Deirdre and Lainey Rob a Train, which just came out on March 17th on Netflix. Nobody noticed it because Iron Fist came out and everybody was busy bitching about that.
Yep.
but this movie was actually enjoyable, and that's a thing that unfortunately probably will end up getting largely buried. But Zach, why don't you kick us off? Why you can explain to the audience here why we decided that this was a movie we needed to talk about on our very special episode of Archie Digest.
Well, it's a special crossover episode because Ashley Murray is the star of the show. So, or the movie. Sorry, it's not a show. You know, it's funny. Amazon Prime and Amazon does movies really well. Netflix, I'm trying to think of, like, other than a couple documentaries, I'm trying to think of the last movie from Netflix that I watched that I enjoyed. And I'm blanking. They do TV shows really, really well. Like, I haven't watched one of Netflix's TV shows yet and not at least enjoyed it. It's at minimum as good as one of the better network shows. But this is a solid, it definitely has an indie feel to it, independent film.
Yeah.
And I loved it. It's a lot of fun. It has that, you know, film that I think that, I don't know if exists anymore in the 13, 14, 12, maybe, I don't know, like the kind of the heist film for kids, you know, like whether it be Goonies or something like that. Obviously, this is not, I wouldn't compare this to Goonies, but it's a very different vibe. But, you know, the film that, you know, basically where a bunch of kids tell the adults where they can stick it.
Yeah.
And they end up, you know, outsmarting them. And, you know, the main adult here that, well, not the main kid here, is Ashley Murray from another fantastic show, and that's Riverdale.
Yeah, and my obligatory, and this will fulfill the obligation of Emerald City Video talking about an older movie, and also something that happens almost every episode of both podcasts.
Yeah.
If you noticed, one of her teachers, Missy Pyle, who's a recognizable character actor to anybody who, you know, is into a lot of indie film and even some really mainstream stuff. I think she was in Legally Blonde.
Yeah.
But Missy Pyle was Alexandra Cabot in the 2001 Josie and the Pussycats movie.
Oh my God.
So it's kind of, it's interesting that we have Josie starring in a movie.
It's true.
With Alexandra Cabot. I believe, particularly from the credits that say introducing both of the two main female leads, that Ashley probably had not yet landed Riverdale at the time when this movie was in production.
Yeah.
Although, by the time the movie was being promoted, because they didn't really start pushing it at all until, like, January,
yeah.
Every piece of anything that I saw, Riverdale's Ashley Murray. So, just jumping into the conceit of it, basically what happens is that there's a family that is living essentially on the margins of society. They're literally on the wrong side of the tracks in the sense that they are a poor family who live within, like, spitting distance of a railroad track. And the first scene of the movie is that the teenage daughter, which is Ashley Murray's character, Deirdre takes her younger sister Lainey and her younger brother Jet to pick up their mom at work because her mom apparently has wrecked the car.
Yep.
And you get the sense that the mom is kind of a screw up, even just from those first couple of lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
But then the premise for this film becomes a serious, serious downer because almost like they get there and she's being dragged away from the cops after having essentially thrown a big screen TV at a police officer.
Yeah, it definitely, one might say, goes off the tracks. Yeah. Sorry, I thought you were going for that, and then when you didn't. I was like, okay, I gotta go for that. But it's amazing, totally. Because, like, yeah, that moment in the film, it's definitely the moment where I'm like, oh, this is going to be a very different film than I thought it was, because it was still playing with, like, a little bit of the comic nature, because everybody has their cell phones out, as they would, you know, like if there was a woman freaking out holding a big screen TV over her head and threatening people with it, everybody would be, you know, having their phone out. But I thought it was going to go in a very, like, oh, this is going to be like a little more dark indie, you know, film, because I didn't watch any trailer, didn't read anything. I only literally, Russ, you told me, oh, you got to watch this film, it's really great, and we'll do a thing about it. And I was like, oh, okay, sure. I like her. She's super awesome in Riverdale. So, and also the, you know, literally the imagery of it, it seemed interesting. But yeah, that's a moment where if you're watching, you think it's going to go one way, and then it goes a little that way, and then it kind of, I got to stop with the railroad metaphor, so I won't.
Yeah, I mean, and I think one of the interesting, you know, and the like the resolution to this, or not really the resolution, but the end of the kind of premise, is that who is, I don't know, maybe 16 or 17 for the purposes of the movie, because she's definitely not 18, because there's a whole plot point about CPS being there. But Deidre has to essentially care for her siblings in the absence of her mom. Their father is out of the picture, and you meet him pretty early, but he's not really a factor in the first half of the film.
Yeah, and in fact seems to be legally not allowed to be around, based on one offline that I remember.
Yeah, there were several references to, like, I get the impression that when their relationship broke up, he and the mother, that she got a restraining order against him.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting, that's, like, he's an interesting character. It's weird, because everything in the first half of the movie feels kind of, it feels like stuff that you've all seen before, with kind of the loser deadbeat dad and the, like, kind of really self-involved mom. And they actually really play with some of those conventions really effectively in the second half of the movie. About 45 minutes in, you get this kind of revelation about her, like, what is going on in her mom's head.
Yeah.
And it totally changes that entire character.
Yeah. Because you're watching this and you're getting the, oh, so this is what the scenario is. Mother goes to prison. The oldest daughter has to, you know, kill her dreams off and basically take care of the kids. And yeah, it definitely starts to go off in a different direction about halfway through the film, which is really fun.
Yeah. It's actually interesting. There's a line that seemed kind of throwaway at the time, but then became a big kind of turning point for some of the characters, where the mom tells Lainey about how she had been like a beauty queen and they wanted her to be a reality TV star. And essentially her dreams got derailed because, and that was unintentional again. But you know, her dreams got pulled off track because she got pregnant.
Yeah.
And so having her behavior essentially forced Deidre into that same role is kind of a weird piece of kind of parallel storytelling.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that, actually. There's a fair amount of parallel storytelling where it's, you know, the thing that you, the other example that I would give is, there were two different instances, one from her mom and one from, her kind of career counselor at school.
Yeah.
Where they have the same line within about 15 minutes of each other, which is, that's not what I meant by that. Or, you know, that's not what I meant. And one of those cases, it's pretty clear that is indeed what they meant and that the person's just trying to get out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But having, again, it's kind of like setting up this thing where these kids are kind of functioning as their own little unit and there are no reliable adults around them. Like, one of the things we've talked about in Riverdale is the idea that Jughead might not be a reliable narrator because he's got his own kind of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. That's fine for a TV show because it adds drama and it adds intrigue and it allows for the possibility that people are being misinterpreted or misconstrued. And that's how you see things like Polly being a totally different character when she arrives than you expected when she was mentioned. But if you're a kid and all the adults in your life are pulling this, well, that's not what I meant by that.
Yeah.
Then that's not exactly good.
No, it's definitely, I mean, while we're talking about it's making me think of the series of unfortunate events where you have adults that are completely, I don't know about completely incompetent, but the guidance counselor is at best checked out and at worst incompetent. The actor's name.
You're talking about Tim Roth, the railroad cop?
It's not Tim Roth. It's
Tim Blake Nelson. Sorry.
Yeah, Tim Blake Nelson. Everything. Actually, it reminds me the big movie that this is really comparable to is Holes for me.
That's a really good comparison.
Yeah, not only because I believe Tim Blake Nelson in that as well.
I think so. Yeah.
But again, where you have these kind of uber smart kids, or at least one very smart kid, who is going up against, you know, the people who are trying to keep not only keeping them down, but, you know, misjudging them, either not necessarily because of their color, but because of their place where they live and everything. I mean, like, literally one of the stereotypes in it is that they live right next to the railroad track. And that's one of the reasons why things happen. I don't want to get too much into it. Yeah. Not that there's not like a lot of spoilers type of thing. And yes, he was in Holes. I was correct. But
I mean, I think it's safe that we can tell people that Deidre and Lainey rob a train because that's the film.
Yeah. But the investigation and things that go on into that, it's not spoilers. It's so much as there's a, not necessarily spoilers there, but things that are like really fun when you find out them as they come along in the plot. So I always think the other film that I find a Raising Arizona, is what we do. We can basically do a 5 for 5 on this, but you know, it's very Coen Brothers. And that's not just because Tim Blake Nelson is in it. It has a bit of a Coen Brothers vibe. I think that actually if the Coen Brothers did a rewrite on the script, it probably would be a huge, it wouldn't just be a Netflix film, it'd be out in theaters and be big. But, you know.
One thing that I will say, you touched on it a little bit. Racing Class is kind of weird in this movie, and in a good way for the most part. It's one of the few kind of movies with an indie sensibility and movies that are trying to kind of say something about society where the lead is poor and black, but a lot of her journey is more about poverty than about the black experience.
Yeah. Well,
it's always dangerous for a couple of white guys to be like, oh, that's a really cool exploration.
Yeah.
But this is a year where we've had a lot of really good films exploring the black experience. You have Moonlight, you have I'm Not Your Negro. So looking at a movie like this and saying like, oh, this is kind of exploring the other side of that coin of like poor people living on the margins, you know, where she is a person of color, but that's not the primary thing operating against her, or at least it's not the primary thing operating against her in this specific narrative.
Well, because of the school that they're in, this is like the first like 8 minutes, 10 minutes of the film. They kind of get you think is that no one goes to college from this school. It's weirdly like it's also interesting in the fact that there is no place to this film. Like there's the house that they're at, the railroad tracks, and the school. So you don't know what this place is, which is also super interesting because you don't, it doesn't let you get any stereotypes on anything, which is really great. I don't know if this is in California. I don't know if it's in the South.
We know it's in Idaho because of the pageant.
Oh, it is? Oh, shit. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't,
Teen Idaho.
But it's so completely doesn't read. Like I saw that, but like it doesn't read as any place, which is super nice because you don't, you know, the fact that you see that many, there's also like the school that they're in has a lot of minority people. So I think maybe that also stereotypically, or as to say people of color, stereotypically like wipes out the Idaho feel,
it had a very, our high school was like a really mixed school. It was, I wouldn't say 50-50 of white and non-white students, but I would say at least, like, it was a predominantly white school where at least 30% of the student body was non-white.
Yeah.
And I would say that's probably the mix that you're looking at in this movie, yeah. is that it's not, again, in a lot of movies when you have an underperforming school, it'll be chock-a-block with nothing but minorities, especially if your lead characters are non-white.
This is not a Michelle Pfeiffer film.
Yeah. As evidenced by the fact that there are certain storytelling tropes that I kept expecting to happen throughout the course of this movie that didn't quite happen. The things that I really expected the father to do certain things that, like, as you're watching the movie, you're just like, oh, okay, he's going to do that.
Yeah.
And in almost every case, you would see the, like, really obvious kind of thing that this sort of movie always does.
Yeah,
and this movie kind of turned right instead of turning left, which was a nice, like, it was a nice thing. It was a nice way to keep you kind of on your heels a little bit and not quite sure where the movie was going, because so many of the characters act in such a way that it feels like Goonies, or it feels like Holes. It feels like a movie that you're familiar with, and it feels like a movie that you know.
Yeah.
And so you're just like, oh, okay, this sort of character always does X. And that's not what ends up happening. The one big exception, I would say, is Tim Blake Nelson's character.
Yeah.
Partially because my note about his character was characters where you know exactly what his personality is in the very first spoken line.
Yeah, yeah.
If you remember what his first spoken line was on camera, when you see him on the news talking to a reporter about a train robbery.
Yeah.
They say, now Mr. Truman, and he cuts them off and says, that's Detective Truman.
Yeah, yeah.
That guy. Okay, yeah. Great, got it.
Yeah. I mean also I will say he's it's kinda like if you see Steve Buscemi in a film, you're like, I'm pretty sure I'm getting Steve Buscemi here. You know, if I see Nick Cage in a film, I'm pretty sure I'm getting Nick Cage, you know, especially at least in the last 10 years. But, you know, I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, like, I'm literally looking through Tim Blake Nelson's thing, and I'm like, yep.
That's him, yeah.
That's him. I mean, even in Fantastic Four, he was kind of that guy, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Which is, I freaking love Tim Blake Nelson. I think the best thing ever he's done was Syriana, where he actually did play a little bit off character, off type, but
yeah. I think the last big observation, and again, kind of staying away from spoilers, and I have a bunch of little trivia things that we can kind of run down once we're done talking about the main points of it. But the last kind of big thing narratively that struck me was that this movie, and you mentioned this a little bit, you talked about this a little bit, has a kind of an 80s, 90s action comedy vibe to it, in the sense that the internal logic of this movie's resolution doesn't actually hold up.
Yeah.
But kind of, whatever. Yeah. It's satisfying storytelling, and so you kind of, you know, I've been invoking the MST3K mantra a lot lately.
Yeah.
you know, this movie is not exactly an earthbound movie to begin with, so to speak. And so little things like the internal logic not holding up, if the story's good, it doesn't really bother me that much.
Yeah. I don't know if this works as a off point, but I mean, one of the thing, like, I took a couple notes, the little, which is, again, is a very indie film thing. There's a couple moments that almost reminded me of Community. A little bit, like when they're plotting the train robbery, they make a poster board, like school presentations of everything that they're planning.
Yes.
And like one of them is they have to raise, because as we say, you find out in the first like 8 minutes or well, but like their mom's in jail. And so they have to raise the bail money. Yeah. And so they have this like intricate, it's your get like a little like,
oh, they raised money, like
yeah, thermometer thing.
Yeah.
And it's just like those little bits are amazing. And then there's one scene again, like you'll forget this by the time it gets there. But one thing is that they have the, and this is like another one of those actually that, because there's a couple things in the film that if you know poor, if you know broke, I'll say broke, not poor, because they're not poor. Their mom has a job. They're doing okay. She's saving up money. You know, it's like there are things like in their life that are, you know, they're the people that are one paycheck away, you know, not to go like all Noam Chomsky on this film, which is a little over the top, but you know, you did bring me on this show. So, I don't know what you expected. One thing I love is, there's like a lot of little things like their backpacks. Like if you live in the inner city, you live in an area, there are backpacks that these kids have. And again, it's not a color thing. It's not a race thing. It's a class thing that like these kids have this. And like one of them, the middle kid has like, it's not a burlap, but it's a plastic burlap. I don't know how to describe it. Backpack.
It's kind of like the bags that you get at Comic-Con almost. And, like that.
I'm trying to think of more, or if you go to IKEA, you get those big blue bags.
Same material. It's like a vinyl thing that has like a floss mesh kind of woven through it.
And there's this great scene where she's being chased by somebody and she hides, which, you know, in the shot, it's very clear that she's hiding there, but since she has this backpack on and she's hiding behind a bunch of trash, which the trash bags are those bags, are like those burlap plastic bags that you get. And she's hiding and is able to get away from it. And it's like, when you see it, you'll understand why it reads what I'm trying to explain. It doesn't read as well as I wanted it to, but there's like these really, really cute things throughout the whole film that again, have that, you know, I think maybe like Spielberg, you know, like those moments that like, I was watching Indiana Jones again, finally. And there's
like the result kind of.
Yeah, there's all these little moments that are very, not just, I don't want to say 80s, but like it shows the care at which the filmmaker put into the film, you know, and it's a big difference between, like, if this was a mainstream film, I don't believe that those things would be there in the same way that, like, I rewatched the Indiana Jones film this past weekend, and I was like, holy crap. Spielberg used to care about his films, you know, and like those moments that like really showed that he understood the scene and the time and the kind of everything and wanted you to notice these little things that were like in the edge of the frame or whatever. And that's one of those things that this film does really well, that kind of puts it out from any number of the kind of generic, whether it be Disney or generic teen kid films that come out, you know, 30 a year that go straight to video or you never really pay attention to.
Yeah, exactly. Is there any other big kind of big picture stuff that you want to talk about, or should we run down kind of, I have a bunch of little observations that we can kind of comment on, joke about for, you know.
I think that we've covered the ground on the bigger picture things, but this is such a, there's a couple big picture things on this film, but this film is really held together really well by kind of its moments.
Yeah. And there's a lot of really good performances in it.
Yeah.
It definitely kind of puts lie to one of the things that I think Riverdale and other shows on the CW are always fighting against, which is the idea of less famous or, you know, quote unquote CW type of actors not being as good, because not only is Ashley playing Deidre, but also the woman who plays her mother, whose name I'm of course blanking on right now, plays Joe West's girlfriend on The Flash.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's a weird, and again, at the time of this movie going into production, there was no idea that they're gonna be working, you know, these guys are going to be working for Greg Berlanti on comic book TV shows at the same time.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to me that you have all these people who kind of ended up randomly together, you know, the Missy Pyle connection and things. And it's just kind of like, that's totally random coincidence.
Yeah.
But so some of the other little things that I got, and this could merit some kind of a discussion. Was it only me, or did Jet as a character read like he was maybe on the autism spectrum?
The youngest kid. You know, it actually, I could see that, but I also could see being the younger brother to a very strong-willed older sisters, because there's certainly, yeah. It read like there was a bigger gap between the first two and the third that could literally have just been me, especially considering Ashley is one of those actresses, as we've discovered, what is her age?
I think you said she was 27.
No. But I'm saying she's one of those people okay. You look at and you go, like, if she put on different clothing, she's a college student. In this film, she has high school kid clothing on, and yeah. She's a high school. Same thing with Riverdale. You know, I mean, Riverdale, even in her, because obviously she wears a lot different clothing, because when she's being a pop star and everything, or pop musician, she wears different clothing. She reads a bit older. I mean, she's she's freaking 27 years old, which is insane.
Yeah, let me tell you, in person, she definitely, like, she's very eloquent and she's very smart. So I wouldn't necessarily have pegged her as a teenager, but you know, I've met her 3 times now, and I wouldn't have guessed anything over like 24.
Yeah.
So the next kind of observation that I know you and I talked about when we did our episode about Civil War, why is everybody moving doing the giant establishing captions? The other side of that is I really like the way that they do the cell phone stuff. And yeah. at one point, the snail mail, like her mailbox, gets a similar treatment. The mailbox is more just a kind of neat, creative choice that I think allowed them to do some storytelling very quickly by essentially giving us X-ray vision into what was in the mailbox.
Yeah.
But yeah. The cell phone stuff happens throughout the film. And I like when people have a clear and concise vision for kind of how cell phones operate in the world of their movie and how that's going to be depicted on screen.
Yeah.
Because it's such a big part of our lives right now. And realistically, especially if your protagonist is 17 years old, it's going to be a big part of their world. So I like the idea that filmmakers put the thought into finding kind of a narrative shorthand.
I think that Sherlock really upped the game on that with the way that they do it. And there's been a whole bunch of other ones. I'm actually another YouTube channel that I have to shill for. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem that they're updating anymore. And I think I probably sent you these links from these places like 8 billion times. But Every Frame a Painting is a fantastic YouTube channel that kind of breaks down different things in cinema and how to look at them. It's interesting. He's the guy that does them is a professional editor. And you know, they have like a couple ones that are like how to do Edgar Wright, how to do visual comedy, right. It's absolutely amazing. They're also funny. One of the best ones that like would be relevant to our crowd a little bit more is they talk about the Marvel symphonic universe. And talk about how, I think I've sent you this one, and they talk about how Marvel is completely and totally lacking a symphonic universe versus DC. However you might feel about it, DC, especially like the Nolan films, have a thing. But they did, I'm trying to look for, here it is, they did a YouTube thing. Yeah, just if you just go to Every Frame of Painting, a brief look at texting and the internet in film is a really fantastic breakdown of what works and what doesn't when it comes to texting. And it just makes you notice it. The reason I bring this thing up, which is so off topic, is that watching this will make you appreciate films like this that do these things right.
Yeah.
Like the Edgar Wright one will make you appreciate, like, I never really noticed it. And as a person who went to film school, as a person who studies film, I never really noticed like why I like Edgar Wright films. I just did. But like you watch this thing and it compares to films like Old School and other kind of, you know, whatever one-off comedy sort of, you know, forgettable things. And it goes, holy crap, like the craft, it matters. And that's why, like, you know, when you're watching films like this, like, even though, you know, I'd say I give this film an 8.5 out of 10, maybe a 9, because I just enjoyed it, you know, filmically. Yeah. But it has like moments, and it shows that like this film shows that not kind of everybody involved in the film making process, not even just the actors, have a lot of promise and have good filmmaking in their mind, which is always nice for like, you know, independent comedies and independent things like this, where like you can make a really cute film and not really care, and it'll get good ratings and do well enough that, you know, you can make you get the budget for the next film.
when you're doing a movie like that, kind of putting in these extra little touches that show that you want to excel and not just kind of, it's not a paint by numbers thing. It's not a, no, nothing in this movie feels mailed in. Everybody is really doing some solid work.
Yeah, most certainly.
So a couple of other little things. There were two things that really struck me as kind of funny in the Riverdale of it all, aside from the Missy Pyle thing, which I mentioned early on, but there's at one point she says something to another character about her father, and his response is, "Whoa, you got a dad?" And not only is it a funny line kind of on its face, but I found it doubly funny considering how long it took us to finally meet her dad on Riverdale.
Yeah.
And then also one of the things that that they don't tell you about Deidre right away, her middle name is Josephine, which, as we know, is Josie's full name.
And it should be noted, by the way, that because I was just looking this up, and because the cast is such a hodgepodge of like people like Missy Pyle, who has, by the way, like, search Missy Pyle on MissiPyle on IMDb and look at this woman's, like, look at this woman's career.
Oh yeah.
Dear Lord, she is starting like 2007. She has like 15 things a year. Like, this person, This woman is working so much and like, and doing a lot of like really good stuff.
She has a podcast, which is funny as hell.
Shit. I didn't know that. I just remember she was in Harold and Kumar, Escape from Guantanamo. I hate to say it, like, I'm sorry, Missy, but that's, I don't know how you feel about that. I love that film, but like, that's where I remember you from.
But well, I mean, like, it's funny because when you like, even when you just Google her, the first page, and like, not all of this stuff is stuff that I love. And I think I can safely say that the seven things I'm about to name, I don't imagine there's anybody who enjoys all seven of them equally. But the seven things that come up between like her five movies she's known for on Google and two like wikis that pop up are Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the Tim Burton version, Dodgeball, Gone Girl, The Artist, Galaxy Quest, Family Guy, and 2.5 Men. What in the world kind of career is this? You know, but yeah, you look at her and you look at Tim Blake Nelson, you have these kind of Hollywood veterans who probably are incredibly, incredibly undervalued in terms of what they bring to a movie. Yeah. And then you look at some of the people who are kind of in the mid-range, you know, Ashley, like we said, has kind of come into her own now, but they had, you know, she was essentially a beginner by the time they were making this film, but there are like kind of middle of the road, you know, Danielle Nicolette, which is the woman from The Flash that I was talking about, who is like, you've seen her on Law and Order. She's been around the block a few times in terms of some movies that people would recognize. I want to say Kenna McEnroe, who plays the CPS person.
Yeah. She's been on like,
she is the corporate accounts payable Nina speaking a moment from Office Space.
Yeah.
And so, like, you have this kind of hodgepodge, like you said, of, you know, the two title characters, Ashley Murray and Rachel Crowe, are literally in the credits as and introducing.
Yeah.
And then you have a combination of, like, indie film people and people everybody would recognize, and then random, like, people who, if they've worked before, I don't know it. Brooke Markham, who plays Claire, was really good, and it's... That's saying something, because she is a character who could so easily just not have worked. Yep. She's Lainey's best friend, And it's the, like, she's fiercely protective of Lainey in the first handful of scenes.
Yeah.
And then something happens to essentially break them up. And it's like 180 degree split where then you have, she's essentially Lainey's primary antagonist for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And so easily a character like that could read as fake or annoying or whatever. It doesn't read that way. It works pretty well.
And she plays really, really well against her opposite, because like almost every character has their cohort.
Yeah.
In the thing, like the middle kid has Brooke, I should say Claire, which by the way, weird. She plays Claire in two of her roles, but anyway, has Claire, and then Deidre has Tim Blake Nelson. So it's and each one is really, really well paired up, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And kind of to that point, Danielle Nicolette is really good with, and I'm gonna take a minute to look him up because it's gonna drive me crazy if I don't, but with the actor who plays her ex-husband or her ex-boyfriend. I don't know if it's ever established that they were married. They have, and part of this might just be because of the fact that I'm rewatching it right now, but they have a chemistry that reminds me of Carla Tortelli and her ex-husband on Cheers, where
the
running joke in the movie is that he's toxic and she hates him on a kind of visceral level, but that she can't get him out of her system. And that, you know, this guy's Chet is the name of her, ex-husband. He's another guy, played by David Sullivan. And Sullivan is a character actor you've probably seen in something, although you might not recognize it right away. He was in Argo. He was in The New Girl.
Weirdly though, you might actually, if you're an indie film person, which is my, I guess, every episode I have like one word that I use like 8,000 times. Aesthetic was last week's. But indie film, Primer, which is a really fantastic film, really worth renting. And really worth, I guess it's still renting, so
yeah, you can rent it on
Amazon. You can rent it on Amazon, but Primer, highly recommend it. I think this is one of those like films that was literally made for like, they returned the video cameras, so they made it for like $12 like a metal box. he was one of the main characters in the film, and he's one of the reasons why the film really, really works. Which is surprising again, because it was his first film in 2004 that he did. So,
and it's interesting because if you go to IMDb and you look at his headshot, he just physically looks like the dude who plays Mayhem in those horrible insurance commercials.
The guy from John Wick.
Yes.
I feel bad. I actually like him, but I can't remember that. But
So Sullivan is a treat in this movie, and his relationship with his ex-wife is kind of funny as hell. And then the last note that I had, because it speaks to something that you and I talked about already about the location of this movie. Did you notice the name of the actual town that they ostensibly live in?
I did not.
Well, when you go there, you're supposed to have a, I think it's an onion tied to your belt, because that was the fashion. this movie takes place in Shelbyville.
Like the time I caught the ferry over to Shelbyville, I needed a new heel for my shoe. So I decided to go to Morganville, which is what they call Shelbyville in those days. So I tied an onion to my belt, which was the style at the time.
Damn it, where's the lemon tree?
And there is, as far as I can tell, no Shelbyville in Idaho. Although there appear to be Shelbyvilles in adjoining states, because if you Google Shelbyville, Idaho, it gives you driving directions to Idaho from both Shelbyville, Tennessee and Shelbyville, Kentucky. But yeah, I mean, you kind of gave your final thoughts in terms of this being like an 8.5 out of 10 movie. Is there anything else you wanted to say before we adjourn for the evening?
The one thing that just worked, that is just so surprising, is that how quickly these kids work mm-hmm. as a family. I don't have a second, like, casting is always a really, really, really hard in lower budget films, because obviously you can't be that picky, you know, can't be that picky, and you can't really usually build off of, you know, things. And
well, and you don't have the built-in, like, if this was a $5 million movie instead of, you know, whatever it was made for, or if this was a more expensive movie, you could hire people who were on a Riverdale-like show last season. Yeah. And who, like, they come with baggage, they come with personality and expectations, you know who they are. And even if you don't know what their chemistry is going to be, you can more or less throw them at the audience without much in the way of exposition and say, like, here's the type of character that you're in for, because that's the person we cast.
Yeah. And I just, they work so well as a family. Like, I'm sold right off the bat that these kids have been living together for however long they've been alive, that they know each other, that there's no, and there's really no I mean, there's character development, but there's no, like, let's spend some time and
there's no dump or anything.
Yeah, no, like they jump right in. They ain't got no time for anything. It's an hour and 40 minutes long. And it definitely, I don't know, maybe you could trim off 2 minutes off of it. Like, I don't know. Like, probably not.
Yeah, it really, it's a movie that feels like it makes the most of all of its real estate.
Yeah.
You know, you're probably right. They're, like, if you really wanted to get, like, if Netflix said, you know, us purchasing this film is contingent on you getting it down to 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Probably you could cut, like, 5 without significantly damaging the narrative, and then it would start to get really difficult.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a lean movie. It does a lot in its kind of limited space. And we say that both in terms of the amount of time, the amount of characters, everything. It's a small scale film. And like you said, there's like 4 sets in the entire movie.
Yeah.
So it really, like, it's a movie that it's really enjoyable. The performances are really excellent, and it makes the most of what little it's given to work with in a big, bad way.
Yeah, well, certainly. It really does need to be noted that I was searching for the budget information, because I'm like really, just interested in what they did with what, because it's one of those films that could have been like $3 million, but it could have also been $500,000.
Yeah.
I don't think it could be as cheap as like $50,000 or something like that, just because of the production values there. But, The title of a SCPR.org radio interview is Deidre and Lainey rob a train. Director says her leads don't need boy crushes, which I just didn't even that was actually really fantastic. Is because I just realized, yeah, there's an ex-boyfriend in the film, but there's no, like, she just not only doesn't have time for it, but it's not.
Yeah, it's just not on their radar at all.
And the middle one has none, and she's definitely old enough. You know, she's
I don't get to know that we actually get to see Lainey interact with any males other than her father and the railroad officer.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the teachers in this movie are all female, and all of the classmates, or at least all of the classmates who were memorable, were female.
Oh, and all the teachers were female.
Yeah, well, and I guess part of that is the fact that
not all the teachers, but the main teachers were.
The
one that you care about, the one that you pay attention to, at least in the plot.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the other thing is, too, when I think about it, Lainey's, like, the scene where she is in class, her first kind of main scene away from Deidre, at some point about two-thirds of the way through that scene, you realize it's not even really a class. It's like a prep session for the beauty pageant.
Yeah, which is like super weird. And also, it should also be noted that in a, you know, in a year that Oscars were certainly interesting when it came to actually having some more representation on things, is that both the director and writer are both women as well.
Yeah.
Which is which is awesome because, again, like, not, I don't know how to say this without end up sounding some weird reverse sexist thing or whatever, but it doesn't, like, nothing in this film, like, you have to kind of be aware of it mm-hmm. to care about it or to notice it. Like, the class thing, the race, any sort of race issues in it. It's not a film that, like, ever deals with anything. I mean, like, even the mom being in prison, there's no fucking issues with that. Like, I really, really enjoy that this film was able to deal and have all those things. And even as a person who's super, super social justice warrior, yeah. I had to actually think about that stuff because, like, if I had just watched this film either on Netflix or on TV or wherever, I don't even know if I would have noticed any of these things, but the fact that I knew that I was going to have to talk about the film is kind of the only reason why I think that I noticed any of this stuff, which is like big top notch. That's fucking good filmmaking. But, I think I may up my rating of it now that I'm thinking about it even more to like just straight up give it a 9 out of 10 for across the board for, you know, it's definitely a film I will watch again. Mm-hmm. It's a film that I'll recommend now that people need to check out.
All right. Well, like I said, we got sidetracked, which happens.
Yeah.
But yeah, why don't you give your information?
Yeah.
You got plenty of other stuff going on besides Emerald City Video.
Yeah. Find I'm a photojournalist mainly. You can find my work at ZDRoberts.com. I also co-host the podcast Around the Lens, which you can find at aroundthelens.com, and also obviously on all the, you know, whatever sites that you find podcasts on, but I also host it's turning out to be I think a monthly podcast now, not a weekly. I've been sick too often to really get into it, but hence the hacking cough that I apologize for. You can go to zdroberts.podbean.com for the Insurgency USA podcast, which is basically a political podcast about the resistance against Trump and, you know, talking to journalists, talking to lawyers, talking to activists about what's happening across the country.
I'm, as everybody probably knows, Russ Burlingame. You can find me at Russ Burlingame, RussBurlingame. That's really long, and I'm not going to repeat it. So if you want to find me, you can do it at ECV_podcast. Both of those things are on Twitter. Both myself as a professional journalist and a verified page and the Emerald City Video podcast are also on Facebook. You should check those things out.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and good night.
Welcome to... I already forgot the name of the show. All right.